Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by Los Angeles Community Policing and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I'll be your host this evening. I'm coming to you tonight from Los Angeles, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. We have a special guest tonight who is a returning family member. We're excited to have him back. He's from Minnesota. We don't get a lot of Minnesota guests, but that's great. There's a need for child abuse issues to be addressed everywhere we are. Mike Tikkanen from Minnesota is the founder of CARA, which stands for Kids at Risk Action, is active all over the place, not just in his local area. But his organization, whose website is at invisiblechildren.org, as if it was one word, invisiblechildren.org, does an amazing amount of work. And I'm on his newsletter, so I get to hear from him. I guess it's monthly. We'll have Mike on in just a moment, but before we get started with Mike, bring on the panel that's going to help me to coordinate talking to him. And the first one, of course, is our co-host for our Monday to Friday shows, Carol Levine. Carol D. Levine is the author of Panic Child, the harrowing true story of sexual abuse and neglect. It's available everywhere, including Amazon. It's autobiographical. It tells the story of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And what it's like now is she has over 30 years of recovery behind her, so she's healed about 85%, she estimates, most of the time. Of course, that's not a consistent figure, sometimes better, sometimes less. But Carol, as she does her work in the Northwest New Jersey and Northeast Pennsylvania area, is extremely active with the communities there. And she's our Monday to Friday co-host as well. And you're always glad to have her. Carol, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I'm looking forward to our guest that's coming back. This is good.
Yeah, and so am I. Mike is a terrific guy, and he has a lot to offer. All right, let's get Michelle and MJ on, too, because we have two extra panelists tonight. This is great. First one is Michelle Bless. Michelle Bless is the author of Out of the Darkness, the Michelle Bless Story, which also is autobiographical. And Michelle is from Louisville, Kentucky, does most of the work she does in Cincinnati, Ohio. She works with a lot of people who are indigent on the street, battered women, lost kids, and so forth. Michelle's ministry is called Out of the Darkness Ministry, and Michelle Bless is a panelist with us several times a week, usually Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, no, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Michelle, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Hey, Carol.
How you doing, Michelle?
Okay. I'm great. This will be my first time hearing this person that's coming on, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, he's good. I like him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Our final panelist tonight is MJ Goings. MJ Goings, of course, is the gal who's most responsible for the majority of the research that goes into certainly the news of the week, the news of the day, and therefore the news of the week. Every day she returns from work after working as a shift supervisor on the overnight shift at the hospital where she's the emergency room. She's a registered nurse and a shift supervisor. When she gets home, She gets to work providing us, doing the research that's necessary to provide us with the articles and research that she then forwards to me and I place every morning on the two websites, LACP and NASCA.org. MJ is a very dedicated volunteer with us from rural Ohio. She's been helping me with my nonprofit efforts for over 10 years, and she joins us frequently every Sunday and every other week. She's here Wednesday, every other week she's here Monday and Friday, depending on her schedule, of course. Thank you so much for being here with us, MJ.
Well, good evening, Bill. Hi, Carol and Michelle.
Welcome
back.
Hey.
How you doing? I never know if the mic is open, so that's why if I don't say hello, you know. Anyway, hello.
I know, that's just how you are.
I know.
your mic does sound a little distant to me, MJ. I don't know if you're holding it away from your mouth or what, but it sounds like you're a little distant.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Let's bring our special guest on. Those who don't know him are really going to like him. Those that do know him appreciate his coming back. Put it that way. Because Mike Tikkanen has been with us before, and therefore he's a member of our family. We are delighted to have him return and catch us up with what's been going on in his life in the meantime. Mike, as I said before, is the founder of an organization called CARA in Minnesota. CARA stands for Kids at Action Network. And his website, the website for the organization, is at invisiblechildren.org, as if invisible children was one word, invisiblechildren.org. We are absolutely delighted to have him back and pleased that Mike is with us for another visit. Let me open his mic and Mike's mic and say
good to
hi.
Be here.
There you go, Mike. Good to have you.
What
good
would
to
you like,
Mike?
To...
Thanks for joining us. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you knew that you were on the air. Okay, good. Well, now your mic will stay open the rest of the show as mine, so don't have to worry about it going on and off. It'll just stay on, okay? Mike, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested and involved in issues of child abuse to begin with. Did you have a personal experience that you'd like to tell us about?
I come at it from a friend that I helped in business who adopted four children in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
Okay.
And they were told some untruths about the children they adopted. And the sadness grew worse and worse over the years, and we've been together for 20 years, which is about how long ago I became a Catholic volunteer guardian ad litem. Mm-hmm. I worked with children for many years in the system, and I came to know, you know, how hard people work, how hard people try, but how much it doesn't work, and where the damage occurs, what needs to be changed. I do believe that the research being done, and there's a lot of people that are putting together a lot of information, I believe there's a lot better answers that are available, and that this conversation needs to be had at a national level to help identify the kids that are in need and those programs and policies that need to be changed and supported, so that it's a mental health issue largely, and if kids get help, the cycle of abused kids having their own abused families and some of the key issues can be talked about and dealt with and fixed.
Yeah,
one of my board members at CARA has made public policy in Europe on children's issues, and really looking at us compared to the rest of the industrialized world and how this country treats children, there's a big difference, and it's not a happy difference.
Yeah.
In most other industrialized nations, children are really, really valuable. And they pay, for instance, daycare workers quite a bit more money. And they make them have a little bit better education so that they can deal with children's issues. Things like that. Where in America, we don't do that. Daycare workers are paid less than anybody else in this country except for food service workers. And we've got huge problems in the schools. Huge problems in the criminal justice system. American institutions today are creating exactly what they were designed to stop. So if you listen to Minnesota's Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, Supreme Court Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz has made the statement that the difference between that poor child and a felon is about 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because she says 90%
mm-hmm.
of the kids that come out of 90% of the kids in juvenile justice come out of child protection.
Right.
There's just a whole lot of things that we could do for at-risk children in our nation that we don't do. I believe the East and the West Coast are suffering the most right now. It's just very difficult. The resources during a recession dry up. I know some of the CASA programs have gone away. And I know that, you know, people try real hard to do what they can with the resources they have. It's the easy thing to do is to blame social workers when a baby's found in a dumpster. It's easy to blame teachers for troubled schools. Politicians do it all the time. But what we really need is to get together and have these conversations and support people that are trying to help these kids and provide way more subsidized daycare, crisis nurseries, the things that make a difference in a two-year-old or a five-year-old's life. Our high schools are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Our jails are full. Mm-hmm. And if we don't get off the path we're on, we're going to end up with just more of what we've been getting for the last 20 years. And it could change overnight.
And the change overnight would have to be if we could rally it to make this a concerted effort that's a national effort and a priority. But as you said at the beginning, like, it's not. You know, we just don't seem to value our children. They're more like commodities than, you know, than the next generation, our future leaders. You know, it's really unfair to have an expectation of them to do better than they do, since, you know, we don't put much resources into them, not as much as we should.
I like to draw attention to the economics of it. I speak publicly quite a bit now. And I've crafted this speech to appeal to those people that are, I will say, less compassionate. And I point to a Federal Reserve study, the bank, the American's Federal Reserve Bank did a study in 2003, and it showed a $7 return for every dollar invested in these children. The greatest dollar that you could ever, the greatest investment that you could ever receive in a public investment. And I, when I talk, I point out, I tell three short stories of children in child protection that I've known. And I point out just one. I say, this young man was at $3 million when he aged out of foster care. And 80% of kids aging out of foster care lead dysfunctional lives, so he's not that different. And he was at $3 million cost to the county at that time. That didn't include the people he'd stabbed, the teacher he beat up. It didn't include the property damage he did to the 29 families that tried to adopt or foster him. You know, he was a very troubled young man. I still love the kid. I mean, I saw what happened to him. He had the worst kind of abuse imaginable and no viable treatments. And so by the time, and he's always been a state ward. He's always going to be a state ward. And I point out to people that, you know, the real true cost to him at this point is probably $6, $7 million. He's got AIDS. That's very expensive medication. He could live for a long time. He could be a $20 million person to our county and our state. Now, if they'd done a background check on the man that got him, that got custody of him, they'd have found out that he spent two-thirds of his life in prison for exactly the same kind of crimes he was going to commit on his son. And there was a court order in an adjacent mm-hmm. state to keep him away mm-hmm. from those boys. But that's the cheapness that we live with in our system, and they're so overburdened. This conversation is so over, you know, it needed to happen 10 years ago. We really do need all of us to talk more openly about these things.
Well, we're going to be preaching to the choir tonight. We know that. But we're also going to be asking them to do something specific. And that is, you know, a lot of our followers are adult survivors of child abuse. And then there are a bunch of us who are not yet in recovery and a few, you know, who are interested in the issue. But we're going to speak to the adult survivors and ask them to really join this battle in a different way, in a way they haven't before. We're going to ask them to come out of the closet, in effect, you know, and because they have a specific special interest in this and a voice that's unique. The children don't have a voice. The community doesn't seem to care or think that it's a taboo topic, especially when you talk about childhood sexuality in the same sentence. And, of course, the adults who have been abused keep it as a secret, which runs most of their life. It's the foundation of their life and the root of many of the problems that they have in life, and they're not ready to talk. But those of us who are in recovery, you know, we do have the clearest voice, and as soon as we're comfortable with, you know, inside ourselves with the fact that we're in recovery, I want us to come out of the closet and speak in mass, because there's an awful lot of us, but not, you know, but nowhere near the number have been really speaking loudly and clearly. Of course, this group is an exception, and you are too. But that's the message. That's one of the messages to be proactive now, because as you say, it's not a matter of how much we spend either, Mike. We spend $124 billion a year on issues of child abuse. It is a matter of how we spend it, you know, but not we. There's enough money to handle this, I think. It's just not being done very well.
I challenge you on that for at least the time.
Yeah, okay.
A point about education. People say we spend more money per student than any other industrialized nation. That's true, but it's completely because those kids aren't ready to learn. We're sending kids into the third grade to fail. They just don't learn how to read. They've got all these issues, and we haven't learned how to deal with them. And so teachers right now are dealing with things that no other nation has to deal with. The mental health issues of 6 million kids reported to Child Protection a year, 3 million calls representing 6 million kids. And kids in Child Protection suffer from PTSD until recently, until we really started to count vets, at twice the rate the vets returning from Iraq and Iran, or Iraq and Afghanistan. And it really is a big deal that these children get help so that they can go to school and learn. Because if they can't learn to read by the third grade, there are states that have used failed third grade reading test scores to project prison space needs out 8-10 years. You know, we really, 25% of kids with arthritis as adults in this nation. And so you say $120 billion, you know, that's $1 trillion. And if you look at war and defense and where we really don't ask for accountability, and I understand a lot of money is misspent because programs don't work and we can't measure them, but we could measure them, and it's gotten all out of whack as far as what we actually do. But again, I made the statement that I'll follow up on your statement. The kids have no voice. Well, they have no voice in the homes they're raised in. They have no voice in the courts that rule their lives. And the media doesn't do anything. You know, they have no voice in the media, and there's no voice in politics. And so to measure what it's going to take to fix it, once the cycle's broken, it'll save us a lot of money. The cost of crime in the United States is between $1.6 and $2 trillion a year, insurance numbers, you know, on a $14 trillion GDP. So it's a big, big number. And to talk about $120 billion, I mean, to me, that's, you know, I mean, right now the mental health statistics, Dr. Bruce Perry of AVAHealth.org, if anybody doesn't know about that, it's a really important organization. It was founded by a medical an emergency room doctor that recognized that almost everybody that came through his emergency room doors had been an abused child. They lived dangerous lifestyles, they had chronic illness, and they died young. And he started AVAHealth.org. Now it's an international organization. They just finished a 500,000 person study that was supposed to have been a study of diabetes people, overweight people that couldn't keep the weight off. And it turned out that the vast majority of those people had been abused as children. Now, the medical community has just done terrific research in this area. Dr. Bruce Perry has made the statement concerning mental health that if we haven't solved these issues by the end of this generation, and he's done 35 years of research on it, if we haven't solved these issues by the end of this generation, 25% of Americans will be special needs people by the end of this generation. So $120 billion in the scheme of fixing what is really the biggest problem this nation has.
But that doesn't include some of the things that you threw in there. It doesn't include that. That's not the cost of education at all. It's not the cost of incarceration at all. That's just trying to deal with children who are perceived as abused. And then we know that, you know, very few of them get help when they're young, too. So an awful lot of us end up in the adult statistic. But I'm just saying that there is, you know, there is a tremendous need. Part of the problem is that we keep recreating the wheel. We keep studying and studying and studying, and nobody does anything. It's a matter of really coming to a consensus that unless we get into action now, with all the things we already do know, you know, that we are dooming ourselves. Like you said, if we don't deal with it in this generation, we're almost, you know, doomed to repeat these things for many generations to come, because we're creating, our future leaders are not ready. They're not going to be ready.
And my experience also points to simple things like crisis nurseries, subsidized daycare, early education programs. Children that are involved at least for 6, 8, 10 hours a day in a place that is safe with mentors and role models. You get deep into the subject, you realize that these children are just born into circumstances that are so difficult, and the stork doesn't deliver coping skills. They got to come from somewhere. Now my state, I'll tell you a personal story at my state. My board member, David Strand, approached the new governor 10 years ago, and he showed him the studies from Art Rolnick and the Federal Reserve and said how important crisis nurseries were and how you get a $7 return on those dollars spent on subsidized daycare. And that governor, the first thing he did was dismantle. He's not the current governor, this last one. Dismantle subsidized daycare. The waiting list went from 34 to 3,400. And the kids that I had in my caseload at that time were actually, they told the family that because he couldn't afford daycare, and he'd been a felon, but he was a decent man, his wife was really a basket case, and because he couldn't afford daycare, they were going to take his four children away from him. And they told, you know, they basically told us that it's cheaper, it's a better investment to take those kids out of that family. I get so unhappy when I look at how states are run. In Indiana, I spoke last year, the governor there redirected the funding that was promised to families that adopted special needs children, a few million dollars for transportation, education, and welfare. After the 500 adoptions of special needs children were completed, Governor Mitch Daniels redirected those funds and used those funds to pay bonuses to people that cut the most from the programs. So who's going to adopt Indiana's special needs kids this year? No, I get terribly upset. It happens state after state.
Well, you should be. You should be upset. It's an upsetting thing. You know, we're talking about a slice of the community that's abused that we do identify most of the time as being even higher percentage-wise at risk than other children, even though we do use the figures that probably national figures of 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys who will be sexually assaulted, for example. We frequently say there are exceptions that are even higher, and one of those groups is kids in the foster care systems, for sure. And so this is it's a special, special need. Let me bring our panelists on, Mike, just to give them a chance to say hello to you. They haven't done so yet. And I'll start with Carol Levine, our co-host, who I believe you've met before, of course. Carol is calling in from New Jersey. Carol, please say hi to Mike.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing? I'm glad you're back.
Yeah, nice to be here. Beautiful.
Yeah. I want to make a couple comments here because I know what you're talking about with the special needs kids and so forth and how they end up being special needs kids. Right now I'm going to all the daycare centers and handing out all kinds of information on child abuse because a lot of those people, even the directors in a lot of these cases, are not educated enough to spot abuse.
Right.
Now, it's been my experience that if children are not, helped at an early age, many times they do end up in juvenile detention. Some of those kids are from foster homes. A lot of those kids are from foster homes, and they're not really bad kids. But they end up getting into trouble. They run away. They're runaways, okay? And this is what I dealt with in juvenile detention, where kids like this, and then, of course, you had those that were more hardcore. They did get into trouble, and they came from dysfunctional homes, not from the foster care system. We had in our detention center special needs teachers because by that time the kids already were behind, and they're well behind in their studies. They can't concentrate. They're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They have all kinds of different maladies that they have to deal with, all different kinds of problems. So I understand what you're talking about. And if we don't get a handle on this, if people don't come out of the closet like Bill talks about, speaking about being, survivors of abuse, and if we don't address the issues of our children being abused and just child abuse in general, how much there is out there, then, yeah, we are going to have another generation of what we have now and maybe even worse. So that's what I have to say.
It saddens me that we are, and I do understand it from a personal perspective, how hard it is to speak about it. But for the rest of us, like me, it hurts me greatly that people don't want to talk about it. It's a painful subject. I think this separates us from the rest of the industrialized world because they do. They have more public service announcements. They face this more directly than we do. And even with my family and friends and the people that I know how painful it is to hear about this. But unless and until we talk about it and bring the issues out on the table, they're complicated. They need to be solved. We've got to talk about it. And once it's a national conversation, and it will be, it has to be, because it's breaking our schools, it is breaking our cities, it is breaking the United States of America. I mean, we used to be a world leader in the quality of life indices across the board. America was number 1, 2, 3, 4. You know that California had the largest gross domestic product? It was number 4 in the world, the state of California. I think now it's 10 or 11, but, I mean, at one time it was just huge. And we have more money. We have this huge economic engine. We invent things. We do things. We go places. But now we're 91st in staff-to-student ratios. We don't even rate anymore in many of the safety issues. We lead in sexually transmitted diseases worldwide. We've got some states that look like Afghanistan when it comes to the well-being of people, and especially children, child mortality, things like that. So it saddens me that people run from the conversation, and we do need to keep it out in front of them, all of us, all the time.
We have an expression that we use, and I use frequently, called that goes your sick as your secrets. And this is addressed to those of us who are afraid to come out. And first of all, I understand that even to get into recovery requires coming out. But that is the transition between being victimized, being one of the many tens of millions of American adults who are currently carrying this secret in their life, between being a victim and getting into a healing journey, into recovery, and that needs to happen. So, obviously we're going to concentrate on the children tonight, but for the adults, that this is part of our message that we give out all the time. And we try and provide all kinds of resources for them, of course, to get into recovery. We know, those of us who are on our healing journey, how much better life is once you get on it. But try to convince somebody to open up when they feel they're going to be judged, that they should be ashamed of what happened in their youth, that they're somehow responsible and so forth. And none of that's true. But that's what's in their mindset and keeps them away from opening up themselves, Mike. Now I'm going to bring on Michelle Bless. Michelle does work with underprivileged kids. Well, so does Carol. Michelle in the Cincinnati area. So let's bring her on and get some perspective from her, too. Michelle, you're on the air with Mike.
I'm just glad to be here and glad to hear him. And the only thing I can say is that even though you haven't personally experienced that, you said, but you dealt with the kids that you've been dealing with, that have experienced that, just the fact that I hear the love and the compassion that you have for children that have been sexually abused or just abused, period. I can hear that. I can hear it. It's like I can hear your heart, and I love that. And we need more of that. So keep doing what you're doing. I love it, and I'm looking forward to hearing more.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you. I'd like to tell a quick story about a powerful thing that happened to me recently speaking. I spoke to a group of Masons, and there was quite a few of them, and they were very attentive, and it seemed like things went very well, and then there was a question-and-answer period, and one of them stood up. He was a great big guy, quite a few tattoos on him, and he finished my speech for me. He had been an abused child, and nothing more powerful could have happened in that room that night. He was just said a few words about what it was like, And they're from a guy like me who just talks about institutional stuff and the mental health issues and, you know, the things I talk about. He put a personal twist to that that will be with the rest of that crowd forever.
So,
and I do
believe
that, you know, that's it takes guts to do it. I admire that.
Well, this is the challenge that we're putting out to the community that's in recovery, because we know that within a few sentences, like you're saying, we can convince someone that we do indeed know what we're talking about, and they will listen. And I can't tell you how many times, virtually every time I've ever spoken to any significant group, even if it's 10 people or bigger, people come up to me later and say, I was abused too. They do it all the time. And that makes sense because, you know, about 20% of our American public, you know, either will be abused, is being abused, or has been abused. That's the number. It's 1 out of 4 girls, 1 out of 6 boys. That's 20%. You know, 1 out of every 5 children and 1 out of 5 adults, therefore, because they all turn 18 at some point. but we just don't, you know, the community continues to think it doesn't affect them. Well, it does. It affects them in a myriad of ways. MJ Goings, I'm going to bring on now, Mike, is one of those people who has the kind of experience you talked about that emergency room doctor has. She sees it all, too, because she's worked the emergency room for, I don't want to say how many years, it's up to her if she wants to tell you, but a long, long time. And she's also, like you, a non-victim. She did not suffer child abuse herself, but like you, very committed to the causes and issues that we discuss. And, you know, it's not just us survivors. It's also people like yourself and MJ that really mean a great deal in this fight. So we want to acknowledge her and you. MJ, you're on the air now with Mike Tikkanen. MJ is calling in from Ohio.
Hi again, Mike. You know, you talked about the strength that you see in people that tell their stories, and I've said that so often, not being a survivor of abuse. When I hear people here on the show talking, telling their stories, the strength that I hear, it's just amazing to me that people can come forward. And it seems each time they tell the story, you know, they get stronger. And it's such an important thing to do. So many times I think, I can't speak with authority. I've not been in their shoes, you know. I can be very compassionate. I can sympathize with what I hear, but to actually say I've been there and no, I don't know. You know, the people that have been there have. And so I feel that when they speak, you know, they really have the voice that people are going to listen to.
It's a powerful point, and actually it brings us back to the core issue is that these children have no voice. They have no voice at all in their families. There's no book that comes with childhood. There's no voice in the courts that rule their lives. The media doesn't know them until a baby's found in a dumpster or a 12-year-old shoots his father or something terrible happens. And they have no voice at the political level. So it is up to everybody that can step forward, even just a little bit, because the conversation is so overdue. There are just so many. It's exponential. It's been going on for generation after generation in this nation for 50, 60, 70 years now.
Well, and this is why I've started just recently, actually, to use the expression come out of the closet, because I recognize that there have been other topics that have been difficult for America to discuss, yet somehow we've gotten over the taboo, and we've gone on to, you know, there was a time when we were young, Mike, you and I, when you could not say the word cancer in public because it was not polite. So we said the big C behind a hand to somebody else. Did you hear? She has the big C, you know. But today we celebrate cancer with pink ribbons and races and all kinds of campaigns and so forth. As we got over it, as more and more of us discovered that we did know people who had cancer. In fact, we had it ourselves. Well, the same thing was true with the Civil Rights Movement. The same thing was true with the Women's Rights Movement. The same thing is true with the Gay Rights Movement, which recently, I think, has reached their tipping point. Thank God. It took a long time. But, you know, that the issue of sexual orientation was such a taboo topic and people were so homophobic that it could not be discussed politely in public until enough people came out of the closet, literally, with their sexual, you know, orientation. And as they did that, we began as a society to realize, well, it does affect us, because I didn't realize Uncle George was gay, but I still love him. It doesn't change how I feel about him, or my neighbor, or my coworker, and so forth. And now enough people have come out, and it took decades, as you know, for this to happen. We're now at the place where it is in the dialogue, and I'm not saying we have all the answers, but it's in the dialogue. What are we going to do for the rights of gay and lesbian people and transgendered people? And that's the tipping point. And that's where I hope we can get to with this effort. It's really a primary goal of mine to someday be able to say we played a part in getting this dialogue to be comfortable in just sort of daily life. Not, you know, something you can say at a cocktail party, something you can say in public, something you can share honestly about from your own experience.
That's what we do at InvisibleChildren.org. Actually, it is a civil rights issue. These children deserve to be heard.
That's right. I agree. I present it that way all the time. Tell us a little bit about your perspective about that, Mike.
Again, please?
Would tell us a little bit about your perspective at Invisible Children as far as it's being a civil rights issue, because I completely agree with that and concur.
Yes, it has taken so long. Actually, this nation to this date has only one real law that protects children, and that is the imminent harm doctrine that says that the police can remove a child if their life is in danger. I have a personal story about that where I had two children as a caseload, a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old girl. 49 police calls to the home. The 7-year-old had been prostituted. I called. They finally took the children out of the home only because the 7-year-old tried to kill the 4-year-old in the presence of the police officers. I called the juvenile officer that had been at the scene, and I asked her why it had taken so long. And she quoted the imminent harm doctrine to me, basically told me that they're so overwhelmed in that part of the city that that's just the way it is. And so, really, children have no rights. I mean, that's as close to no rights as you can get. And that's the last group that I know of that has no rights.
These
children deserve more.
This is exactly the point I try to make over and over again, that since they have no voice and no political power of their own, it has to be we adults who are compassionate about their needs that do the talking for them. There is no other option. And yet they are the sole remaining group that I can see that on a basis of one, you know, one thing, their youth, separates them from the rights that the rest of us enjoy freely. And it's just, it is not fair, and it is a civil rights violation to deny, you know, anyone who's a certain age and younger, by as a group, from the protection of the state and the freedom, you know, to grow and nurture and so forth, to be at peace and be safe.
An optimist, but I do believe that the problem has to do not with a meanness, but a lack of awareness and some kind of discomfort with the topic. And if those two things, you know, if the discomfort could be minimized, back to conversations, just you got to have more of them, and people get more comfortable with the subject, the awareness will grow. I really, when I started talking about this 10 years ago, it was almost foreign to the people in the room. Today when I talk about it, everybody's got a foster child or a child that has a foster child or a teacher that works with special needs kids or some story related to the thing that I'm talking about. So everybody does know. It's in the room. And the issue has to do with clarity, with understanding what is it that we're talking about? Why is this going on? What can we do to make it better? And so when I repeat the call for crisis nurseries, repeat the call for subsidized daycare, repeat the call for early childhood programs, that's what's going to change things. And people today, they don't quite know why. They don't know why we should ask that daycare workers get educations and deal with mental health issues. And, you know, when I wrote the book Invisible Children in 2005, I interviewed a lot of teachers. Art teachers that I interviewed wept. They wept. They cried. Because the No Child Left Behind Act put all the really troubled kids in their room because nothing happened
right.
in ARPS.
Right.
And the Prozac kids and the really – and art teachers are beautiful people that love children, love art, and wish to do wonderful things. And they end up being detention secretaries, the last
right.
thing that they're capable of. We've ruined
right.
teaching. Excuse me, and I'm sound a little harsh here, but, I mean, we've done a lot of terrible things to the educational system, and it needs our support, as do social workers, as do the people that are doing the daily work in this very difficult field. They need more resources. They need more training. You know, they made me a guardian ad litem with 40 hours of training, and I walked in from my middle-class background into something that I still don't understand, and I've studied it for almost 20 years now. It's complicated, and it deserves some resources to educate people. That's all this is. And so, when, again, back to money. Yeah, it's going to cost us something to fix this, but not anywhere near what it's costing us to leave it broken like this. The kid I told you about, I can tell that story a dozen times, dozen families, because the average number of kids now, you know, they stay, sexually abused kids are 4 years in the home, the oldest kid. And it gets, you know, big families. I've been on some with 7, 8, 9 children. All
funny
stories.
It's funny you should say that, Mike, because I'm an adopted child myself, but at the time of my adoption, which is 60 years ago, it was in New York City, and my parents were allowed to adopt 2 children. That was the maximum you could have. And they got me, and a year and a half later, my sister. But even though we had, my father came from a family of 13, and my mother had many in her family, we couldn't, the rule was you could have 2 and no more. Today, if they feel like you can handle them, they'll pile on the kids. In a, you know, and there are still kids in the system who will never get served, never get a foster home situation, or at least an appropriate one. But that's how the times have changed. Now, I do want to make one point before we're going to go to our chat room and our phone lines in a moment here, Mike. But just in terms of one of the topics that we've discussed that I want to go back to, and maybe we can think about it, is how the media handles this story is very important to me. And it's done a poor job. Frankly, part of the reason is that for the media, it's also a taboo topic. It's salacious sometimes to describe what happens to a child or a fetus or a youngster, a teenager, and that story will stay on the, you know, on the news cycle for a few hours. The bigger stories, when you get into the Penn State stories, the Sandy Hook stories, even the story about what's happened to these 3 gals in Ohio, the tune changes from, it's not a story of how the child was abused as they grew up and continue to be abused and what it meant to them as a victim and society. It becomes an issue of a major football program or an issue of gun control or an issue of, you know, the evil people that there are a few of us among the community, like the fellow that abducted the 3 girls. But the point is, it quickly disappears as being coming from the perspective of the human rights and the civil rights and of the children and the victims involved. And that we have to improve. The media needs to help us with that, and we need to ask them to, by delivering statistics to every story. I mean, if they just would do that alone, in every newspaper article, if they would put 2 or 3 of the primary statistics that relate to that issue, each time they did a story, or 10 seconds worth of statistics, because they're shocking, but we don't hear them enough. And the community, while it knows children are being abused, just don't have any idea at the rate at which it's occurring and how serious a problem it is. So we're going to think about that, and I'm going to ask for some comments from you, Mike, after we come back from this. But I just want to take a break quickly to remind people that we do have a chat room that's open. We want you to engage in the chat room. There are a couple of people in there right now who are having a conversation, and when there's something appropriate and a question or a comment that we need to bring to Mike's attention, we'll do that for him. But the other way to participate is by calling in, and we're going to open the phone lines at this point for the rest of the show. for questions and comments for Mike Tikkanen from Minnesota, the leader of the CARA organization, whose website is at invisiblechildren.com.
Org. Go to .com.
.org. Excuse me. Sorry, it's work. So the number to call is 646-595-2118. 646-595-2118. And I do have the correct description in the description of the show, so people will have gone to the right. But it's invisiblechildren, as if it's one word, .org, for Mike Tikkanen. 646-595-2118. All right, let's bring Carol and Michelle and MJ on, too, to make a comment, and then we'll go to your thoughts about what I said about the media. Carol, you're back on the air with Mike Tikkanen.
Hi, Mike. You know, I've worked in a lot of different agencies, too, and it's true. There is not enough staffing at times. I have to admit that. And I wonder why. I went to one of the directors in at a methadone clinic that I had worked at. Of course, that wasn't with children. But and I said, I have a caseload of 85, which is ridiculous. A work week of 35. It makes no sense. I had to take files home, and they're not supposed to leave the building just to keep up with my work. Okay? Now, a lot of times there's corruptions in these agencies, which I have to admit, I know of it. And, you know, the staffing that is there many times are overwhelmed because they have too much of a caseload. And then you have those staffing, too, that just don't care. All they want is the paycheck, okay? So you have a combination of the two. As far as society goes, it is a societal issue. It really is. People out there have to realize that they have to become involved with this child abuse, with this epidemic that plagues our society, okay? It plagues our country. It's a pandemic. It's all over the world, but we deal with the United States right now. You know, because if we don't have change soon, there's going to be change, all right, and it's going to be for the worse. It's just going to get bigger and bigger, and because child abuse is up, it's not down. Okay, and when I go out to all the different organizations like the daycare centers and to the schools and wherever I go, churches, I've tried churches, not getting too far there, unfortunately. I hate to admit it. But the point is this, wherever I go, wherever I speak, whether it be the schools or the daycare centers, sometimes they act scared when I walk in with all the statistics because they're not aware of it. They don't want to talk about it. And, you know, it's a sad world that we live in because until people wake up, realize that they should be held accountable to the neighborhoods, the communities. If they know about child abuse and they don't report it, then they should be held accountable. And there are a couple of states, I think, where they're going to try and find people if they know of abuse and they don't report it. I have heard of that. It should be all over throughout the country. We have to be the voice for these children. Because, like you said, like we all say, we have no voice. They have no voice.
And the comment was made in the chat room that the cost of abuse to society is the loss of human potential. And that cost, you can't measure in dollar and cents, which is, of course, true. Let's bring on Michelle, get her to make a comment or ask a question. Michelle, you're back on with Mike Pickenham.
Not really a question, just more of a comment. Just keep doing what you're doing. I'm loving it because it's rarely that you hear people that have not been abused but have such compassion like you do. And I'm loving it. So keep doing what you're doing. Keep making the noise. As we as survivors, we're going to keep making the noise because eventually we're going to be heard. And I know this for a fact. So keep doing what you're doing. Looking forward to hearing more.
Good. Thanks, Michelle. And finally, MJ, to make a comment about what she's heard recently. MJ, you're back on here with Mike.
Yeah, going back to what's being said in the chat room, Lynn made a comment that, you know, the loss of human potential can be measured in dollars and cents. And my comment was, yeah, but sadly enough, just about everything is measured in dollars and cents. And you say how we should get the statistics of child abuse out there, Bill. Maybe in addition to that, you need to throw out the hard, cold numbers. You know, sometimes people can't understand or they don't listen until you start throwing out the billions and billions and billions of dollars that this is costing us annually. Annually. And that
right. But
every
I do
year.
I do include the financial cost as part of the statistics, and they're amazing numbers. But go ahead, MJ, finish your thought.
Right, right. We do. But what I'm saying, in addition to the media getting out the raw numbers of how many are abused, let's also encourage the fact that they need to throw out how much this is costing every single individual in the United States. How much is coming out of your pocket every single year?
Right.
Please use my website for some of that data, because we work really hard to put it out in front of people. You can search it by different statistics, different categories, and I promise you, you'll find some really interesting information there. It's blatant. You know, in Minnesota, we spend $500 million a year, a small state, to house about 3,000 people in the criminal justice system. There are two states, I think California and New Jersey, that have spent, and I think still are, $250,000 a year per juvenile in the detention centers. We just finished sending two judges to prison in Pennsylvania for getting a commission for sending thousands of innocent juveniles into detention on a commission basis. It was a privately held deal. I could go on. I mean, there's just so much money in the justice system, you know, now the privatizing of things. And when we start looking in any given area, you know, we really do need to police ourselves, talk about these things, and it has to be open. We need to take that flashlight and shine it everywhere and start these conversations. You know, when you mention the media conversation, is it too early to jump into that, or is that appropriate?
No, that's fine. This is exactly right. Go ahead.
I want to say two things. The sadness is the newspapers are broke. And the old days, they had beat reporters that really got into it. And I was fortunate. I had two of them in Minneapolis that made a big deal about my speech at the UN and a big deal about a couple other things I did. But they were kind of retiring. And what happens now is they don't have money for beat reporters. And so I got a call. It was 2 years ago. A baby had drowned in a tub. And there had been 13 police calls to that home. And two reporters called me about that because I write a lot. And they asked me questions, and they were just appalled that there had been 13 police calls. And I said, that's nothing. I said, I just finished a case where there was 49 police calls to a home, and the 7-year-old was prostituted. See, they don't investigate. There's so many other things going on, and we all have our bones to pick. So it really is up to us to badger. You know, if you can find and make a friend, and I've been fortunate in making a couple of friends in the media, and so they'll show up at an event that I'm at or something, and they'll moderate or something, and they'll print a little story. Both that and the legislative side of it, whatever one is comfortable with. But that's when I end my speech. At the end of each speech, I say, I'm only asking for two things, friends. And that one thing would be that you'll talk to somebody about what you've heard here tonight for about 5 minutes a day, just about 5 minutes a day for 28 days. Because after 28 days, it'll be a habit. And it'll feel bad if you stop. And that accomplishes two things. The one thing for sure is that you're going to learn a little bit about it as you talk about it. It's going to keep you interested, and you're going to know more about it. And the second thing is you're going to spread it around a little bit. And it's the wildfire that needs to get lit, the growing of awareness. And hopefully we can bring the media in with us.
Yeah, I think it's one of the missing elements is we really haven't we don't have a media that's as engaged. Of course, the whole news cycle thing has changed so that it's now, you know, constant news. And an awful lot of what passes for news is really opinions and talking heads of people who don't really know it from the what they're covering from the inside out, you know. And quick, resolutions of stories and on to the next story. And so not a lot of in-depth either is going on. But every time we have an opportunity, I try to turn the story back to the issue of the trauma of the children that they're going through, and I try to bring up some of the statistics, both monetary and just numbers, numerical numbers, of how many. It is really shocking to most people if you can get them to listen to even a couple of statistics at a time. And I like you, agree. You don't have to tell them all the statistics all the whole time, the whole, you know, in one sitting. But if they,
no, right,
if they heard
too much.
It, you know, you, that's too much, so too overwhelming, Mike. You know, they can't get it. Wow. Fuck,
yeah.
That's how you scare them out of the room. But a few at a time, over time, you know, can change some hearts. And we need to change some hearts if we're going to make this a priority. That's exactly what needs to happen. It's stop thinking about ourselves and start thinking about, you know, our future, which is our kids, you know.
Our communities, our schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's a public
mm-hmm.
health issue. I didn't say that, but
mm-hmm.
it really, truly is a public health issue. With
sure.
this Dr. McCollum and the AVAHealth.org is how I remember it. AV as in Victor Health. AVAHealth.org. This medical community has combined, you know, thousands of medical people and all the studies they've done. There's so much information. There's so much information. I mean, we know in Minneapolis they did a little piece of a study. It's called the ACEs study. And we know where that 60% of the violent crime committed in Ramsey County, which is St. Paul, Minnesota, was committed by children from 3 to 4%, by youth from 3 to 4% of the population. They know who the children are, they know where they live, and they know how to take care of them. They know what they need. And I know, one last story about that is that when I got the Children's Defense Fund training some years ago in Tennessee, the woman next to me was from Missouri. And they had what was called the Missouri Miracle. And she told it to me in kind of a humorous way. She said, well, I think the governor got up one day and he said, they had 90% recidivism in the juvenile justice system. She said the governor got up one day and she said, I don't care what you do today, just so it ain't what you did yesterday. Now, basically, that's not true. What did happen, though, was they went to restorative justice. They realized that kids are kids and they needed to be treated like children, and the kids committing the crimes were abused and neglected kids. So they brought in mental health therapies and treatment homes, and they went to 90% not recidivism, 10% recidivism within just a few years. I don't know where they are today, but I do know that different pieces that we've touched on here tonight are, that work really wonderful, and they need more exposure. And if that were to happen and it was catch fire, we don't have to. Victor Weiss speaks a lot about this. He's out of Minnesota, I think. And he says 3 to 5 generations we can fix this. I think this could be fixed in 5 to 10 years if we just put the resources there. The savings would be absolutely fantastic. And we'd have safer cities, graduate more kids from school. The sister school to where I went to school is Roosevelt South in Minneapolis. They had a graduation rate of 29% for 5 years running. I mean, when you get into how it's measured and all that stuff, too, we're fibbing on some of that stuff. And I'm not pointing fingers at teachers or anything. I'm not, because I know how hard their work is. I know there's Prozac kids in the classroom. They're having trouble teaching any lesson, just keeping
mm-hmm.
kids safe, really,
mm-hmm.
things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, your first appearance impressed us a great deal with the work you've done. Ever since, you've been a resource for us on our website, and we do recommend you and some of the things that are on your – and I've taken advantage of some of the things that I've found on your website. And we want to continue to recommend you, and we will, because when you appear here and you're as engaging as you are, Mike, and as knowledgeable as, you know, we claim you as a member of our family.
Glad to be here.
And, you know, and because everybody needs a family, right?
You bet.
We need family members that are as articulate and as knowledgeable and as hardworking with the heart that you have. You know, it doesn't matter if you call it a human rights violation situation, a mental health situation, a health care situation, a civil rights situation. We're in crisis with how we deal with our children and therefore with how our country is developing, because they are our future. And we are in total denial if we think that you know, what we should have been discussing all through the last presidential campaign and the one
right.
before it was the financial situation we find ourselves in when we don't pay attention, you know, to the true treasure of our country, which is the kids. And we're wasting them at an alarming, alarming rate. We are going to ask you to take us through some of the things that you can point to on your website when we come back. But I do want to say, Mike, that remind people that this is an open show now for community people to call in, and give them the phone number one more time. We may or may not get more calls, but we have plenty of people to ask you questions and to pick your brain a little here, regardless. However, everything we do at NASCA is meant to be community-oriented and engage the community. So please do call in if you're listening and you're thinking about it. Don't think about it anymore. Dial 646-595-2118, 646-595-2118, and push an additional number 1, and it will remind you to do this, so that I know that a certain person with a certain phone number wants to ask a question, make a comment, share something about their own life, whatever you'd like, with our special guest for tonight, Mike Tikkanen from Minnesota, whose organization, Kids at Risk Action, CARA, has a website, a wonderful website, at invisiblechildren.org. Invisible Children spelled as if it was one word. Invisiblechildren.org. Mike's a returning family member and special guest, and we're going to have you back again. And, you know, you can engage with us, Mike, in any way you wish as a family member, and we'll be delighted to hear from you. We don't want to wait so long next time. We want you back more frequently. But keep us... take us on a little tour of a couple of things maybe that are important to you about the work that you do, perhaps by using the website since we're all on it at this point.
Well, I do believe that the CASA program, the Court-Appointed Special Advocate program, particularly volunteer piece, is hugely important. I believe social workers try really hard to do the work in the courts, in the system, as do educators, as do the people that are in the institutions.
Let me just interrupt for 1 second, Mike. We are big fans of the CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
We are, and there are hundreds of them all over the country. But you made a comment that I let go by earlier that I don't want to let go by now, that the CASA organizations were losing their numbers. The numbers of them were diminishing, and please do talk to that issue, because we are big fans of CASA. Explain what it is, of course, but the fact that it's declining instead of increasing, we think that there's probably, 10% or 15% of what the need is out there, even though there are hundreds. You know, there should be one in every community.
What happened to 18 months ago was they lost 12 of their $15 million federal funding, almost everything. And so people lost, if they had a paid director, that went away, and now they've recovered about half that money, maybe even a little bit more. But you can't make public policy short-term for something like this. It's like funding your schools 1 year and not the next. I don't know if you guys know this, but in Michigan, there's at least one school that's out of money, and there is no school now for the final 6 weeks of school. Everybody went home. And the teachers that even volunteered to teach for, not free, but... we'll get paid someday. But the CASA program, as an example, I think it's about 20 years old, because I think I was fairly new at it when it started. Mm-hmm. I'm still on the board in Minnesota. But as a practical matter, they took this huge economic hit. And I know the CASA in Wyoming just evaporated, and at least a few other ones have been hit pretty hard. We lost our director and had to kind of come back a little bit and learn how to raise scrambling for funding as a board. Now, I don't know, as you say, maybe 20% of the kids get a CASA, and then there's different kinds of CASA. I like to really promote the volunteer CASA, because people like me will just, get to know the kids a little bit better. We're not pushed to have, a paid guardian ad litem. The lawyers can have 20, 30, 40 or more cases, and where the paid guardian's the same. But as a volunteer CASA, I just took one or two in over 12, 13 years. I worked with about 50 children, got to know them pretty well, and I believe I did a pretty good job as far as, the best I could do with what I knew in guiding them through the court process, which is really cold. And not because the people are cold, because the system is cold. I call it a 10-foot pole rule. You can't have a child in your car. You can't do this. You can't do that. If there's anything those kids don't need is to be treated that way. They need, at that point, people that love them and show them a little love. And so I think Florida is changing that a little bit. But this national conversation just hasn't been had. It's gone on so long. And again, I'm not pointing fingers at the people doing the work. It's the people that make public policy. Because we really do need to look more like the Europeans. I know people, their backs cringe when I say that, but they worship their kids. I have a story about a Minnesota girl that had a baby in Norway. She was a drug-using 16-year-old. And once a week, the Norwegians showed up with clothes for her kids and a little bit of money and make sure the shots and the medical stuff got done. It doesn't happen here, even to citizens. Mm-hmm. So I get CASA, you get in the family, you get to know them, you tell the judge what's going on, and I have no dog in that fight. I'm not a paid social worker. I'm just trying to do the best interest of the child.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sometimes people get really unhappy with that because kids come out of homes, and nobody wants that. But I've had terrible, terrible homes, and it had to happen. Too many
kids. Well, and we are big advocates for the use of volunteers, not only in child systems, but obviously the whole concept of the original effort that I've had gone on for since 9/11 was referred to the fact that I had been a volunteer with the police department and I knew the term community-based policing, and you know I knew the benefit if you could appeal to the public that and give them something real to do and support them just a little bit that they would be willing to come forward. And I believe this is also true with children, as you're saying. That there's a kind of an untapped resource that's out there. I think Americans, bottom line, would care if they were able to see the issue the way you and I see it tonight and the panel sees it tonight, but they don't see it that way yet. And we have to educate them to get them up to speed before it becomes a priority for them. And if we give them something to do, you know, not everything has a monetary cost to it. It's, you know, you can get an awful lot of services out of the well-meaning
That's a great point.
Of volunteers.
That's actually what I tell my golfing friends is, what do you want your legacy to be, a 3 handicap or that you work with kids that needed help? And there's a lot of people. There's a lot of people my age and retired and stuff that want to do more. And it's been made rather hard. As a side story to this, I started my volunteer work as a reader in the grade school near my home to kids that couldn't read. Mm-hmm. And me and a dozen other volunteers, 3 hours a week, every single third grader learned how to read. There is just a little volunteer, 1 hour a week for each kid.
You know what? I'm laughing, Mike, because I remember you told us that story the first time you were with us. you started out as a reader to little kids.
Light duty, fun kids, glad to have you there. And me teaching somebody to read is kind of silly because I'm not a teacher and I don't know all that much, but I wanted to try. And it worked.
And what a great illustration of how a community member can make a difference is at the beginning of the story of the rest of your life, which is totally a life of service that we respect and admire. And we are so grateful to you for coming on our show tonight. Let me go around the horn here again and give the panelists yet another chance to make a comment or ask a question of our special guests. Mike Tickenden from Minnesota. Carol, from New Jersey, you're back on the air with Mike.
Yeah, I'm looking at your website, and I'm really loving what I see here. Very well done. But I just want to say one thing. It is amazing. If a kid is just given a little bit of attention from someone, that means the world to that kid. I had to leave my husband because he was a maniac. He was an alcoholic, and I had to work. And I, my son had friends, but my daughter didn't at one point, and babysitting wasn't good enough. So I got her a big sister, you know, from the Big Brothers Big Sister program. And she adored that girl. And I gave them money so they could go out. And today they don't spend quite as much time with the kids as they used to. But she would take my daughter and actually take her to the movies or take her roller skating or whatever she wanted to do and spend that time, that given time. And it meant so much to my daughter. She speaks about it yet today. Mommy couldn't be two places at once. So it's a wonderful thing for people to volunteer to work with children, to be with children, to be their mentor, whatever, because it's so needed.
And you know what, Carol? It meant a lot to the gal who was the volunteer, too, and it still means something to her today, too. So both parties got a tremendous amount out of it. Right, Mike?
Everybody wins.
That's right.
It's a win-win.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Let's bring Michelle on. Now, she works with a lot of street people and domestic violence victims and at-risk kids and so forth in the Cincinnati area, and she does that today. She has a ministry, Out of the Darkness Ministry, that she does it through. Michelle, you're back on the air with Mike Dickinson.
Yeah, I just want to mention that in Cincinnati, twice a month, I go up with me and my team, and we go up to the detention center, juvenile detention in Cincinnati. And the counselors and the deputy sheriffs that are there are so grateful as far as with me and my team, because we are making an impact and we are making a difference. And the difference that we're making is that most of those, because I work with the girl unit. Now, we have a ministry in my church that deals with the boys, but I'm the first they allowed for me to come through there with my own team to deal with the girls. And a lot of them young girls that are in, I mean, well, they have them from, of course, you know, 17 on down, but the youngest they ever had up in there was 9. And so this one particular girl that was that age, where her family was prostituting her out, she was shooting heroin, and, I mean, my heart broke. And she was telling me how she was being sexually abused. And before the week was out, we were able, put it this way, they've been trying to talk with her, and she was like a shell. She had a...
Right.
Attitude. She had an attitude problem. You know, her behavior. She was real mean, and they couldn't get to her. But I was able to get to her because I just sat there and told my story. I allowed myself to go back to the age of 6, so they can identify with me, okay, as a little girl instead of an adult. And it was so overwhelming from her that she broke down, and she was able to go ahead and tell the counselors what was going on sexually with her. And she don't. And so the good news is, they made sure she didn't go back to that home. So from that point, a lot of the young girls that we deal with over there, where the sheriff, where the counselors couldn't reach them, now they're able to reach them because they're telling me, they'll take me to the side or one of my teams before we leave, and then of course we'll go tell the sheriff. The deputies and so forth and the counselors and they're able to reach them, and that's one part of it. And then another one, they had a lot of girls where they call them revolving doors. They'll get in trouble, then they'll be good to get out, go back home, and get in trouble again. And so we're trying to stop from making these girls come back over and over again. So that part of ministry is my favorite because I'm trying to reach them at that age point. Because
I'll let you come back in a second here, but let me mention, because you bring up exactly the topic that I was going to go to next, and we'll let you continue, Michelle. Mike's book is called Invisible Children. The subtitle is Preteen Mothers, Adolescent Felons, and What We Can Do About It. And it's available through his website at invisiblechildren.org. So this is obviously exactly the issue you're talking about is a big one for him. And the book is available in regular printed format for $16.95, but it's also available for $2.99 as a Kindle book. And it's also available, if you wish, if you need to download as a PDF file for free, although they do ask you for a small donation, a $5 donation if you do that, but you can download it as a PDF for free. This is the same title as the website, invisiblechildren.org is the website, and Invisible Children is the name of the book, Preteen Mothers, Adolescent Felons, and What We Can Do About It. So go ahead, Michelle, and just so you know that he's on the same page, literally.
Yeah, and I just want to quickly say, and I tell people that, they always say, well, you know, every kid is not abused or is not, no, they'll say it's not sexually abused and that's why they're in trouble. No, it don't have to be sexual. Abuse
right.
is abuse. A child can
right.
be sexually, but they can be mentally, emotionally. And I will say this, and I will say majority of the children that are in trouble is being abused. They act out because they're being abused in one form or another. So that's my pet peeve. And again, you know, I'm enjoying listening to you because I'm feeling so much compassion and love that you have for children. So
I'll tell you, if we were identifying one trauma that many of these children share, it's the trauma of feeling like nobody cares. And that is a huge
that's
trauma.
That's right. Yeah,
that is
that's
a huge
good,
trauma.
Brother Bill. Mm-hmm.
Right? Right, Mike?
Oh, I'd like to also add, and I'm repeating now, but our Supreme Court Chief Justice, Kathleen Blatz, she's a former Supreme Court Chief Justice of Minnesota, has made the statement that 90% of the youth in juvenile justice system have come out of child protection. So it's just a path, like Marion Wright Edelman talks about a pipeline to prison. It starts in child protection. And mm-hmm. some states don't really have good child protection at all. I mean, nobody's got good child protection, but, I mean, some states are appallingly bad. I won't name them, but if you go to the website, you'll see I write quite a bit about bad states.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I'm still really upset about the Ohio, it was Pennsylvania judges, two of them that were just sent to prison for incarcerating thousands of innocent children. Innocent kids didn't do anything wrong. But they got 10% or 15% of the privatized public, privatized juvenile detention center money for each kid.
That's
they'll
incredible.
Be in prison a long time, but we really, all of us, just got to start speaking up more, talking out as much as we can, whatever comfort level we have.
Totally agree there, Mike. And we're going to bring MJ on to make a comment here now, too. Okay, MJ, you're back on with Mike Tickenen.
Yeah, that situation you're talking about in Pennsylvania, Mike, that had gone on for quite some time, as I recall. But,
took a long time to catch him, and it was an accident that they
yeah.
did.
Yes, yeah. And I can kind of add a comment about that. My daughter is a corrections officer in Pennsylvania, and, you know, she sees this, kids that have come up through the system, and now she's in an adult institution, and here they come, you know. I mean, it's just so common. And as far as volunteering, wouldn't it be great if everybody had that spirit? Unfortunately, I think the majority of people, it's a what's in it for me society, and that's so sad. People don't realize that they can get so much by giving so little. You know,
I'm hoping that some of it has to do with just a lack of awareness and that if more people knew more about what we're talking about. And that's why I tell people, you know, and I ask every one of us to talk to our friends, and I'm sure most of you do, but I talk about this more than most people, and just a little bit every day. And if it catches a wildfire, I do believe there's a grassroots movement here. I don't know how many of you remember the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
Sure, sure.
Well, I was a drunken driver. I was a bad kid. I was terrible. And overnight, those laws changed because mothers got sick of having their children murdered in car accidents by drunken drivers.
Mm-hmm.
It took 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think we can do this in 2 years, but I do think we can do it in 5 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take...
Well,
outspoken, angry people.
Right. I think we can reach that tipping point and that's what I meant by earlier. You know, if I trying to, I was asked this by a radio host whose show I appeared on recently to, you know, what would be kind of a success for your mission? And I really believe if I could give, you know, 5 or 10 years, like you're saying, a reasonable amount of time, and we could arrive in our country at a point where the discussion was able to be had, that would be a success. Because once the discussion is able to be had, then and more people are comfortable with it, then we won't be fighting each other, we won't be denying it, we won't be turning away from it, we will be just as comfortable with the concept of equal rights for women's, equal rights for people of color, equal rights of, you know, AIDS victims, you know, whatever it is, whatever taboo topic it is now, cancer, the equal rights of the child who really needs our help, you know, and that deserves our help simply by the nature of they are a living being in our society, you know, and for no other reason. They deserve that. But we're not there yet, and that tipping point's not going to come until enough of us, angry and not, get out there and talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. And, you know, I know a lot of people see me coming, and they don't want to talk about it, and I'm still at the point where I know people.
Be proud of that.
Well, I wear the blue ribbon on my lapel, you know. I also wear a little badge for the police, some of the police volunteering I do, and those two things are usually on a jacket or a shirt, well, jacket if I go out. I want to wear that blue ribbon because there are occasions when someone says, you know, what's the blue ribbon for? And that's my chance to say, well, I'm glad you asked, you know, and not kill them with the information, but yeah. I walk around with a business card that has some of the statistics and the link to the website and the 800 for a child number, the child help, you know, is a national helpline number that we promote and so forth. And it just gives us a chance to say it, you know. As a matter of fact, I'm very devoted to the issues of child abuse. I was an abused child myself. Some people run. Some people go, really? I didn't know that about you. And some people go, they choke. Because we're not at the tipping point.
Well, I like to believe that they wake up later thinking about it. It comes, the light turns on, but there's got to be somebody at that switch.
I rarely let somebody walk away from me without at least a business card and usually a ribbon, too, in their hand. And maybe it goes on their dresser, maybe it goes in their drawer. Maybe they do put it on their jacket, too, someday, but they go home with it, you know, and maybe it's in their wallet one day when they think about it, going through their wallet, they see it again. Who knows?
Yeah.
All right, we just have, believe it or not, the show is coming to an end. It's been a terrific hour and a half. We have 8 minutes left, though, and so there's time for us to go around the panel once more and also to make sure you get included, Mike, with some final thoughts. But let's let our panelists do that first, and we'll start with our co-host, Carol Levine, with some final thoughts for Mike Tikkanen from Minnesota. Carol, you're back on.
Well, I'm just so glad that you're on again tonight, Mike. I can't keep saying that enough. I need for you to come back again. We all go out, most of us go out and talk about this horrible epidemic. And I wear the blue ribbon and I take the cards, I take the information, and people look uncomfortable at times, but I don't care. Because we have to, like you said, we have to be the voice for the children. And I'm asking for the survivors out there who do feel comfortable enough to do that, to go out and do it. Otherwise, there's not going to be any change. We have to be out there, and we have to talk. And I do a lot of public speaking wherever I can. That's where I go. I try to go on other different radio stations and so forth just to get the statistics out there. And I work with all different ages, not just children. But please come back and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
We, as a grassroots organization, we're not funded by anybody, nor do we belong to any other particular group. But we cooperate with many of them, among them Invisible Children. I do get your newsletter regularly, and I look through it and read it. And I'm so glad that you came back tonight, Mike, to be our special guest again. Because you are, you know, the perfect example of the community in action. Basically, you started out innocent enough being a reader to a child. Look where you ended up. So let's get Michelle on for some final thoughts. Michelle, you're back on the air with Mike Tikkanen.
I just want to say it's been a great show. I mean, I've been sitting back loving it. My leg is fractured, so I'm not able to go to my computer. But when we get off the phone, I'm going to go to my iPad, and I'm going to definitely go on your site and to keep up, you know, with what you're doing. So just keep up the good work, and hopefully you'll come back. And, yes, you are part of the family. You're my brother now, and I'm your sister.
Thank you, my friend.
God bless.
Yes.
There you go. And again, the website is invisiblechildren, as if it was one word, .org, invisiblechildren.org. Let's get MJ on for some final thoughts, and then we'll give Mike a moment or two for some final thoughts of his own. But MJ, please thank Mike Tikkanen from Minnesota for me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We're glad you came back, Mike. And as Bill said before, pop in any time, you know. We can always pull another up to the table.
Thank you.
We can always pull up an extra chair at the table, she said.
Oh, thank you. You bet.
And Mike, we got about 5 minutes left, so time for a couple of thoughts perhaps, but I want to make sure that we covered as many bases as you thought we might tonight and give you an opportunity for some comments here at the end of the show. So why don't you go ahead and wrap things up for us from your perspective.
Thank you. The one piece that I missed that I really do want to make is that I've fallen in love with a doctor in Minnesota's definition of mental health. He's the chief child psychiatrist in Minnesota, Dr. Reed Sulik, and he calls mental health a definition, the ability to cope, just the ability, it's that simple. And as he talks to the group, he says, you know, if we were all to be put down in the Sahara Desert, we wouldn't cope very well because we don't have the skills. So it's just the simple ability to cope. And I do believe that goes back to the things that we talked a little bit about, the special subsidized daycare, crisis nurseries, childhood programs, where children can learn these skills if they don't get them at home. And then the abuse parts, you know, we're going to capture as much as we can with what we have. But the thing that we can solve as a voting public is to make sure that our legislators know how important supporting early childhood programs is, and that the way to fix things and to make more and better mental health, because it's like any other health, you know, if the services are there, we'll be healthy. If they're not, people suffer. That was the one point that I missed that I really wanted to stress, is that coping skills aren't delivered by the stork. They're, you know, they're brought by either the family or by the people in the community, and that's who we are. And so if there's any taxes that I'm quite willing and happy to pay, it would be to subsidize a daycare center.
Exactly. I mean, we got so caught up in the last, I made mention to it, presidential debate about whether or not we were going to pay $3,000 more or $3,000 less, and we're turning a blind eye to the true treasure of our country, was how badly we are wasting our children, and they are our future. And they are our treasure. And if we don't pay attention to them, we'll have no one to blame for the fact that society ends up, you know, behind the eight ball, and we'll have to spend an awful lot more money later if we don't spend it now. As you said, Mike, you made that point several times. Absolutely true. Tonight's special guest has been Michael Tikkanen. Mike Tikkanen is from Minnesota. He is the author of Invisible Children, and he's also the founder of Kids at Risk Action, where the website is at invisiblechildren.org. He's a member of our family returning to us tonight for a second time, but we want there to be a third time and a fourth time. And indeed, Mike, you can engage with us in any way you wish in the future, and we will be delighted to hear from you. And we will remember you well, but we don't want you to wait so long for the next visit to the radio show.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it a great deal.
Okay, this is Bill Murray for the rest of the gang, including Carol and Michelle and MJ, and a couple of people who were in the chat room, Chris, who monitored our chat room tonight, Vicky and Lynn, and I might have missed somebody else who was in the chat room, but or the listeners, who I wouldn't know who they are because they didn't call in, but thanking them for listening and reminding you we're on the air 6 nights a week with this show, always at 8 o'clock Eastern and 5 o'clock Pacific with a live show. But we want to always engage the public, and you're always invited. Tomorrow night we have an open mic show. You can tell us what topic you'd like to start the show with, and we will. And then on Friday we have a special guest for the first time appearing from Ireland, Lurleen Hilliard. We're beginning to have an international outreach, and we've had special guests earlier this week. We had one from New Zealand. We've had them from Israel, we've had them from London, we've had them from South Africa, and tomorrow, for the first time, someone from Ireland, Lurleen Hilliard, who's advocacy is on both sides of the pond, because she does an awful lot of work by telephone and by Facebook to American citizens on this side, and she is interested in someday immigrating to our country. We'll hear from her on Friday night. In the meantime, thank you for listening. May God bless you, God bless America, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Blog Talk Radio.